Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Good morning, Michael Healy Ray.
Thank you very much, Miriam, and thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it a lot.
Well, me too. And I have your new book in front of me, Time to Talk. It's a politics-free zone this morning.
Definitely.
I get enough time to talk to you in prime time about politics. Yes. Tell me, first of all, why you wrote this book, Michael, and what it's about.
Well, I suppose, first of all, to explain the background to it, the people from Gill Publishing, the commissioning editor, Deirdre Nolan, approached me and said that would I write a book? And to be honest, I said no, absolutely not, because I couldn't see how I could make the time, and I wouldn't ever take on a project or go at something unless I knew I could give it 110%. So in fairness, they were adamant that, number one, they would do everything they could to assist me and help me in doing it. So I came back with a proposal. I suppose I'd put it to this way. I called their bluff in that I said, fine, get me somebody that could help me and work with me, somebody who would be professional about what they do, but there's only one time I'd do it, and that was between 12 o'clock at night and 7 in the morning. But I said, I will not engage in anything to do with a book that would take so much as 20 minutes out of the day, because my job is people, representing people, working for people, and I wouldn't let something that I'm doing interfere with that. So, in fairness, they were good, and they came back with a very excellent, nice person, Tara King. And Tara definitely has a set of skills that not many people has, and that is that she was able to put up with me ringing her at those hours. And quite literally, I could ring her at 4 o'clock and say, right, I have 2 hours now, are you ready?
In the morning?
Yes. And she
Tara.
Yes, she never ever once said no, or it doesn't suit me, or, well, you know, this is the wrong time. Same thing, it could be 12 o'clock at night, I could be leaving Dublin and I'm heading for Kerry, and she talked to me all the way home. And how she used to do it was, she had a dictaphone. She's very professional about what she'd be doing. She'd be taping the stories, but then she might interject and ask me questions in relation to what I'd be telling her about. Or maybe the following night or the following week, she'd go back and say, well, now that you, what you were talking about there before, and she'd draw another bit out of me. So she was very, very good, an excellent person.
And let's go back to the beginning. It's largely stories about from where you grew up. For people who don't know Michael Healy Ray, tell us where you grew up and about your parents.
Well, I suppose, like everybody, I adore where I'm from. I'm from a very nice place by the name of Kilgarvan. It's in between Killarney and Kinmare. When I was growing up, I liked where I was. I liked the people. I still do. We had 26 shops. We had 6 pubs. And we were a very close-knit community, like every other small village at that time. Everybody used to go to the creamery. The shops were busy and vibrant. The pubs were busy and vibrant. My father and other good people organised flacules. We had a South Kerry, a Kerry, a Munster flacule, which was a great achievement for a small place, but they all worked together. And, you know, I have great memories of growing up like that. So I wanted to put in black and white just some of those stories. And you might say, what are the stories? They're just the ordinary things that happened. The characters, some of them, people that I admired very much. They might have been council workers, forestry workers, people that I knew, people that I admired. Everybody has their role models. We had a principal, Master Hickey. I liked him very much. I considered him what I would call a sound man. And so I just wanted to put in black and white some of the memories that I had. And some of the things that happened are what we'll call funny. Some of them are serious. Some of them are happy. Some of them might be sad. But it's just nice to account for things. And again, I wouldn't have thought of it myself. But how it actually came about was those people from Gill Publishing, when they approached me, they had heard some interview that I had done. I think it was with Tommy Tiernan. And there was some way that it captured them, and they thought, well, you should have more stories like that and put them in black and white. And that's how it came about.
Tell people about your mother, because your mother was an exceptional person.
Well, everybody in the country knew my father, and rightly so, but I was blessed to have a good father and a good mother also, in that my mother, and I used to always laugh at this because as I write about a little bit in the book, I had big difficulty in reading and writing when I was younger. And I was nearly ready to go to what we'd call secondary school, and I couldn't write my name. And nowadays, of course, everybody, there'd be early diagnosis of situations like that. What was wrong with me? What's known now is that I was profoundly dyslexic. But to me, it was just I wasn't as good as everybody else. But what I always think was funny, the fact that my mother could speak and write seven languages, including Arabic. And here I was, and I couldn't write my name. So it was like one extreme in the house to the other. And she was working with the Syrian consulate when she was in America. And even when she came to Ireland then and married my father, she used to continue with German and French and Italian. She used to go to classes to keep up. You know, if you're not using a language, you could lose it. But she kept up on all her languages, and she was a very smart person. And she had studied for 3 years, I think, at night in New York, studying psychology. And what she always said to me about what happens to you in life, that it's not the things that happen to you, it's how you react to those things. That's what defines you as a person. You could have two people and the same bad thing or good thing could happen to them. But what defines them is how they react to that. Some people, if something bad happens, they lose the head. They might start drinking. They might just become very contrary. Other people would look at it in a way. And I always say this to people who come to me with very serious problems. I say to them, look, your brain is a big place where you must put the problem. When you're dealing with it, take it out of the box, bring it out of the room, bring it to the front of your head and deal with it. But don't go around with that problem being the biggest thing in your head. Put it into a little box, park it inside in a room, close the door and continue with your life. And if you do that with problems, it helps you deal with the everyday problems, because I deal with every type of situation, and you have sad things, you have deaths, you have suicides and awful things that happen to families and situations where young children are left maybe in bad circumstances and sad circumstances. So you have to try and talk to people in a positive way and help them to use their own minds to overcome the awfulness maybe of a situation they're in.
And Michael, you say in your book that you hope, I suppose, the stories in your book are going to distract people from their troubles a bit, but that you also wish that you were able to distract a friend of yours who took his own life. Remind people of that. Is that partly why you wrote this as well?
Well, it was partly, I think, why Gill Publishers came to me, was that it started with a person asking me a very straightforward question. And that question was, had I any regrets? And some people, maybe especially in political life, people don't like highlighting their errors or their mistakes. But I have no problem in the world. If I make a mistake, I don't mind admitting it, because I find it way easier than trying to cover something up or trying to make out you're something or not. If you make a boo-boo, tell it, and it'll carry you further in the long run. But I did make a very bad mistake one time. People might remember, especially people that are around a bit longer, there was such a thing as bogus residential accounts. And it was actually a very simple thing. And there was nothing wrong with it when it started. And how it started was bank managers and people in positions like that, they discovered that if you had money on deposit and if you used a foreign address, you could attract a lot more interest. Nowadays, people get no interest in money anyway. But that time, the interest in banks was okay. It was reasonable enough. But if you had a foreign address, it was a lot more. So you had people who knew nothing about this. They were going to their banks, maybe depositing a little bit of money, their pension, whatever. And here they were being told, well, you have a sister in America or a brother, Johnny, in England. You could use his address. It's a very simple thing. Just change the address in the deposit book and you'll attract a lot more interest. And an awful lot of people did it. These people weren't crooked. They were doing nothing wrong. They were just doing what they were told to do to make more money. And they didn't realise there was anything wrong with it. Revenue got onto it. And they, ordered an investigation. And for instance, this one elderly man, and to paint the picture for you, he lived in a rural area in a house that had a tin iron roof on it, you know, corrugated iron. He would have had running water, but not hot water. He had a big open fire at the end of the house. And like a lot of people who worked hard, he had saved up his bit of money, but he wasn't going to be spending it on himself or on luxuries. And he came to me with a very serious problem. The revenue were hitting him for, it was over 100,000, if my memory is right, it was about 120,000. And I went at his case for him. One of the first things I discovered was they were charging him tax on his pension, which he had deposited. So when I went picky away at it, I brought it down to something like 72,000 euros. And I thought that he'd be happy enough. I had achieved something for him. And unfortunately, he was going to have to pay that. I was coming from a clinic one night and he rang me. And he said, Michael, he said, that money, what are we going to do? And this is where I made the mistake. I said, look, we're at the end of the road with that. I said, do you know, it's 72,000. We can do no more. And that was the time of pounds, Miriam. It was not euros. I said, it will have to be paid. And now when I think back in it, this is the mistake I made. I offered no way out. I was very definite about it. I won't say I was impolite or tough, but I was firm about it. It was a case of, look, we are where we are. It'll have to be paid. And in a very sort of a serious voice, he said, oh, look, Michael, thank you very much. You've done a lot for me, but I'm not going to pay it. And I thought, oh, sure, look, don't mind that. No, you'll have to pay it. This is revenue, like, If we're dead revenue, you'll get the money out. If we're not, mind anything else. And so that was the way we parted. And I was very firm that, look, it'll have to be paid. And he was firm, no, I won't. The following day, I was up on a digger. That was my job, driving a machine. And the next day after that, I was up on the machine and Radio Kerry came on and the dates came on the radio. And my friend's name, the man I had been dealing with, his name was called out. And I rang a near neighbour and you see, I couldn't let on that I knew anything about the case. And I said to the neighbour, I said, I heard a date there on the radio. Do I know that man? And he said, oh, you should know him. All right. He said, sure, he was dealing with you a lot. I couldn't let on, you see, that I did know him. But I was only looking for the bit of information as to what had happened. And I said, my goodness, I said, what happened to him at all? And he said, you know, we can figure it out. The night before last night, didn't he stand up on the kitchen table and hung himself? And it was only then the enormity of what had happened. When he was finished talking to me, he made out there was no way out. He wasn't going to give revenue his money that he had worked and slaved hard for. As far as he was concerned, he had done nothing wrong, which he hadn't. And he thought to himself, well, this man, he brought it from 120 to 72, but he's telling me I have to pay 72. So my answer to this is I'm not going to be in this world anymore. And very sadly, he took his life. I know people could say, oh, look, it wasn't my fault. But look, everybody's entitled to their opinion. If I'd handled it different, you can be sure I'd handle it different today. And when I meet people now that are in tough, hard positions, I feel as though I've a lot of experience that I can read people like a book. You'll be talking about books. I know the person who is in real trouble and I know the person who might say they are and they're not, because often if a person threatens something, they might be the last people in the world to put themselves in danger. And the person who's always talking about that they'd be better off not being in this world, there's actually maybe no fear of them. But I feel that because of life's experiences, I'm better equipped after making that what I would call big blunder. And and to finish the story, would you believe what happened? Even in death, revenue got their money. Because when nieces and nephews inherited, revenue went after them. No, I'm not blaming the people in revenue. No, they have a job to do also. Yeah. But it just shows you how people can make mistakes with bad advice. And an awful lot of people around the country got caught up in that business that time. And through no fault whatsoever of their own.
In your book as well, Michael, there's loads of stories about characters, I suppose, where you grew up in South Kerry. But tell me about your cousins, Paddy and Timmy Buckley, the two bachelor farmer brothers who lived together.
Paddy and Timmy, you'd actually know of these people in a roundabout way. Everyone in the country, I'd say, knows of the tailor and Anstey. And you've read the book, I presume. Well, the tailor actually came out of Paddy and Timmy Buckley's house. That was his home in Lone and in Kilgarvan. But Paddy and Timmy were great characters, but they were what you'd call farmers of the old way. In other words, that time, even when other people had progressed maybe and brought in new farming practices, when these two men, when they were milking cows and feeding cows inside for the winter, they'd be drawing in straw bedding. They'd be drawing out dung, all with wheelbarrows, drawing in silage. 'Twas a constant job of doing everything in the hard way. If 'twas only to knock a tree, instead of using a chainsaw, they'd have the big bandsaw, you know, that one man on one side, one man on the other side, and they'd pull until they'd cut down the tree. And sure, when the tree was knocked, that was an awful operation. But then go and cut it up with bushmans, two bushmans, and they'd tackle the tree, and like they were two savages of men, you know, great workers altogether. Mowing hay then, there was one big field in front of the house. I know every inch of the field. 'Twas Timmy used to mow the field with a scythe. Now, there's an art and a trade in mowing with a scythe, but to knock this field, he'd have to be in the field mowing at 5 o'clock in the morning, and he'd have it mowed for that night. Now, to put it in context, if one of the contractors now was to go in with their tractor to mow that field, there is no way in the world they'd be inside in the field for 10 minutes and they'd have the field knocked. And that poor man would start at 5 o'clock on a fine summer's day, and at 10 o'clock that night he might be finished. And he mightn't even leave the field to eat, that the bit of grub would be brought out to him. So they were great characters. I learned an awful lot from them. They were very self-sufficient. They had a few pigs. They'd have hens, they'd kill a pig, and there was nights, myself and other neighbours, the Murphys and the Roylies, and we'd all gather above there for the killing of the pig, and it used to be a circus, to be honest, and like everybody'd get a bit of something, then afterwards you'd get your own bit of the pig, maybe afterwards you'd get a bit of brown bacon from the bottom of the barrel, salted bacon. And this was the best of food. I mean, you could travel the world and wouldn't get food like this. And even funny things then, like, they wouldn't want to waste time during the day eating. So, like, the spuds could be put down at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And that would be the time they'd eat the spuds, because 'twas the only time they'd allow themselves to a bit of time to eat. So I had great times with people like that. I remember one time Timmy was very adventurous and he wanted to go to America. They had a sister living over in America. And for Timmy to go, it was like a military operation, because number one, somebody had to be got to go with him to sort of mind him and guide him around America. Then Paddy couldn't be left alone at home, because he wouldn't like staying on his own. So maybe I was 13 or 14 and I had to move in with Paddy, which was an experience in itself. And like I say, funny things like that. And you see, there was a Paddy and Timmy Buckley everywhere. Mm. And in every part of Ireland that time, a big open fire at the top of the kitchen. And like when the spuds would be put on, they'd be put on in a big black pot. There'd be enough spuds for themselves. If half the parish was to call, there'd be spuds for them as well. There'd be enough spuds for the skins, for the hens. There'd be spuds for the dogs. There'd be spuds for the pigs. I mean, because they used to have their own garden, you see, and they'd have what we'd call a reek of spuds, you know, a big pit of spuds, yeah. Like. And people like that were very, very special, because they're not there anymore. And what I mean, I don't mean them themselves, I mean people like them. The Paddy and Timmy Buckleys of the world have not been replaced by new, younger Paddy and Timmy Buckleys, because that whole way of life has gone.
Tell about the time you broke your dad was locked out of the Fianna Fáil election office.
Oh yeah, I remember my father was, as everybody knows, a very good man at organising elections and directing elections, but he was directing one election anyway, and he had met with the late Neil Blaney in Dublin, and they had a very innocent meeting, but the rumour mill went into overdrive, and the story was that he was going to run as an independent sort of Blaney candidate. It wasn't true, of course, but sure, the truth never came in the way of a good story. And Fianna Fáil at the time in South Kerry decided that the FF hatchet was going to fall on Healy Ray. And why I word that it that way was the Kerryman of that week. That's what the headline said. FF hatchet to fall on Healy Ray. I think it was the late, great Seamus McConville or somebody like that that had written the story. And there was great writers then and now in all our local papers. But what happened anyway was somebody in their infinite wisdom thought it was a good idea to lock my father out of the election office. And I remember I was walking along the street with him, and we came to the door of the office, and it was locked. And there was a sort of a makeshift padlock and all after being screwed onto the door. So my father said to me, wait there a minute. And he went away and I was wondering, was he gone for a key or what was he? And when he came back, I see this big hatchet in his hand. And I was thinking to myself, by God, it is a big key. And one belt at the lock anyway. And he looked at me, they won't lock me out again, he said. And you can be sure they didn't lock him out. And he continued to do his job. And he did what he used to always do. He ensured that his candidates won. And he did everything that he could to ensure their election and re-election. So it sort of showed that a little padlock wasn't going to stop my father of doing the job that he was given to do.
And there's lots of stories in this book. One quick one before you go. Brain surgery in the pub. Yes. I mean, is that true?
What is? It's the gospel truth. And just for the record, it wasn't in my father's public house, but it was in another pub in the village. And what happened was a person had a problem. They needed brain surgery. Their head needed to be cut open and a procedure was required on their brain. And at the time, there was no cars, there was nothing. The road to Cork was very, very bad. There was no such thing as an ambulance. And the roads weren't tarred. There was just horses and cars. So it was deemed anyway that there was one car. It was owned by landlords in the parish at the time. And they were very nice and kind. They said they'd send their car to Cork for the surgeon. The surgeon came to Kilgarvan. The pub was cleaned. The man was laid out on a table and his head was cut open. The procedure was carried out. And when the surgeon was leaving, maybe the following day or whatever, he said that the man should be allowed to wake of natural causes and not to be woken by noise or anything like that. So there was rushes and bedding put on the street because, as I told you, there was no tar, but the hard road that time outside, when horses' hooves would be banging on it, there would be an awful clitter and clatter. So there were sentries put on both sides of the village to tell people passing through that there was a very, very ill man and that they were to be silent. So everybody walked their horses on the bedding so there'd be no noise. There was no talking. There was no anything. And sure enough, after a few days, the man made a full recovery and came back to full health. So things like that are in the book. And the final story I tell you was about unusual requests. I had a phone call one time from a hospital that would I bring home a man's leg and bury it. And a person that he had two choices. When unfortunately, when a limb is being removed, you can either have it incinerated or buried. This man had deemed he wanted his limb buried. And he said, well, there's nobody in the family to do it, but I know one man that won't let me down. And the matron rang me and she said, Michael, an unusual request. Will you collect a leg, take it home and bury it? I said, I will. I carried a few friends with me. It was late at night when we came back to the village with the leg inside in the boot of the car. We found the grave where it was to be buried and I duly carried out the job that I was asked to do. So at any time when the phone rings, it can be any type of a request. They're all accounted for in the book. And just to say, the book is available in Easons and Super Values and Dubray shops and Amazon and lots of local shops.
And it's a great read. It's called Time to Talk. Two reactions are going to bring you. Miriam, my mother always speaks so highly of the hospitality of Mr. and Mrs. Healy Ray at the pub in Kilgarvan when she sang there at dances with the Dennis Cronin Band back in the 1960s. Plenty of tea cake and oodles of ham and tomatoes with crusty bread. That's from Martina Ryan Murphy and Tralee. And one more. Derek says, I just tuned into Miriam on the wireless. South Kerry stories. I hear Spud Skins and Timmy Buckley. Michael Healy Ray, thanks so much for coming all the way
Thank
from
you,
Kerry
Miriam.
This morning to chat to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael. We'll take a break.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.